Let me in. Shiba shiba. I wanna be closer to you. Shiba shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba shiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your. Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it is the first Monday of the month, understand something. I've got a scientist in the studio today, as I often do. On the first Monday of the month, I have my science envoy from Wonderfest. I'd like to welcome Rachel Porter. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for being here. So before I get into what you do, what I would like to know is, when were you first bitten by the science bug?
It's very hard to trace back. I think from my earliest memories, I was outside like playing with animals and dirt and plants.
Uh-huh.
And then from then on, it's just been an obsession with biology. I grew up in a pretty rural area in Texas, in a few different towns.
Uh-huh.
And so I have memories of like playing with all the lizards and like the carcasses of fish after my dad would go fishing and things like that. So I think I was very into biology from the get-go.
So was it something that your parents encouraged, or was it like, oh no, she brought another skeleton into the house?
Halfway in between, I guess. There is a series of pictures from one time I found a dead lizard as a kid, and they let me like play with it for a few days, and then at they're like, okay, no more. You smell, it smells.
Okay, so did that interest in science carry through all the way to college, or did you leave and come back to it?
I think I did flirt with math a little in high school, and then what I've realized
along that's science adjacent.
That's true. Exactly. So basically what I've learned since then is that you can just merge the two and it's still science. So
okay. So when you got into college, you were still into math, or had you already segued to...
I had mostly segued. I had a minor in math just for fun. Throughout the course of undergrad, I was like, oh, wait, this is actually useful for my research, too.
Okay. So a long time ago, I remember talking to this woman, and I asked her, like, why are you an accountant? Because she was just so smart and talented and pretty, and I was like, why would you do this? And she's like, because I love numbers. And I had never heard anyone say that before, and it just opened my mind, like, oh, that's the person you want handling your numbers. With that in mind, what was it about math that attracted you?
It's just so perfect. There's a right and a wrong. It's clean. Especially, I'm really interested in kind of abstract algebra.
Uh-huh.
And then that, you don't even have to deal with decimal points most of the time. It's just perfect numbers, perfect patterns. It's really satisfying.
Oh, okay. But do you get that same satisfaction from science, because it's hard to get that level of perfection?
Yeah, that's a whole different ballgame. Science is so messy. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why I like needed the math on the side to keep me sane.
Gotcha.
And then in biology, I'm just like waiting in the noisy data.
Okay. So now you're into science. And when I read your bio, it's like you're into bacteria. So tell us a little bit about how you got into bacteria, which I think is kind of fascinating. But maybe other people like. Mm-hmm. What was the courtship like?
Yeah. So I kind of just randomly hopped into microbiology in my undergraduate experience. So I joined a lab right when I started college,
mm-hmm.
and they happened to study E. coli. They're particularly looking at potassium channels in E. coli, which are little proteins that are in the kind of outside of the cell that let it move these ions from inside the cell and outside the cell to kind of move stuff across and make sure it has the right ingredients inside the cell that it needs to behave quickly.
Oh, okay.
Or properly.
Okay.
So I happened to join that lab, and mm-hmm. I happened to realize I really, really enjoyed research and specifically working with bacteria there.
Okay.
So then I moved to a different lab later on. I did some work with fungi, which are also very cool.
Mm-hmm.
They can do so many amazing things.
Okay.
But I think bacteria have a special place in my heart because they're so simple in some ways, but capable of so much.
So does bacteria kind of scratch that itch for perfection because they're so simple?
I think so. I think, yeah. So one thing that's kind of annoying about fungi, and especially if you're working with like mammals or something, is they have a lot of copies of the genome.
What's a genome?
The genome is the set of all the DNA that's in an organism that encodes how it does stuff.
Okay.
So for example, in humans, we have like two copies, one that comes from the mother, one that comes from the father.
Okay.
So you should have two copies of every gene. For bacteria, that's not the case. They just have one. So if you're trying to make any changes in the DNA, you don't have to worry about like doing half but not the other half. It's just either done or not done.
Oh, okay. And fungi have more than...
Fungi can have two. Sometimes they can have a lot more. Fungi are very weird.
Really?
Yeah.
I kind of want to probe your brain about it, but I don't want to get derailed from bacteria. So you were doing fungi, and then you're like, no, they're too messy. Stick with bacteria. So what kinds of bacteria do you work with?
So I have a few different kind of bacterial-related projects. Most of them I focus on E. coli. And so this is not the same strain of E. coli that, you know, gets in lettuce and causes a lot of disease. It's a kind of... attenuated strain of E. coli, which means it's changed a little bit so that it's not pathogenic. It won't make you sick.
Oh, okay.
It's just a nice, friendly little lab bug that a lot of people work with because there's been so much research into it already.
All right. So I'm going to go even more basic because my science education was trash. So what exactly is a bacteria?
So bacteria is a single-celled organism. So there are a few different kind of main classifications that you can put living things into. And so you have some, one of the big divides is between what we call prokaryotes and eukaryotes.
Okay.
So basically this just means, do you have a super complicated structure for organizing where your DNA is stored?
Oh, okay.
And so in things like humans and plants, we have this structure called the nucleus that kind of protects the DNA and keeps it centered together. And then in some simpler
like a little
things,
bubble that holds
exactly.
it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Just like a little shell in the inside to protect
okay.
it.
Okay. Like an M&M.
Exactly.
Okay.
The two layers and everything. For bacteria, they don't have this. And there are a few other kind of complicated structures that bacteria don't have. But one of my favorite things about bacteria is that originally we had the simple image of them having like very few specialized structures. They're just kind of like blobs of gel with random stuff floating around.
Okay.
That's not quite true. There's a little bit more organization than people initially gave them credit for, but that's kind of recently being uncovered.
So what more did we find inside the suitcase of bacteria?
So there's, in addition to having the nucleus in eukaryotes to protect the DNA, they have some special kind of proteins that help coil up the DNA and keep it really tight.
Okay.
And so it's not just floating around taking up a ton of space.
Okay.
And bacteria actually have a very similar protein that will help kind of condense the DNA and keep it packed in. And so I think initially there was the idea that the DNA in bacteria was small enough that it could just kind of float around the cell and do whatever. And now we've uncovered that there are, in fact, these proteins that help organize it in a really similar way to the, like, more complex.
So it's like the Marie Kondo of cells. It's like,
yeah.
You know, or it's Tetrising the heck out of it so
exactly.
that it all fits together tightly so there's room for other things.
Precisely.
Okay, okay. So you've got that, what did you call it, eukaryote?
Yeah, eukaryotes.
Eukaryotes. And does that mean... is that the only new thing that they found, that there's a protein that organizes it?
Ooh, oh boy. I think there are a lot of different kind of small examples. And one thing is that this kind of varies between different strains of bacteria. Even species. So different species have different kind of capabilities.
Okay.
But I think one thing that I'm not... the best to ask about details within the cell.
Sure.
But my area of specialty is kind of studying groups of bacterial cells together.
Okay.
And so we found recently a ton of different kinds of organizations that happen when you have these big clusters of bacteria.
Okay. All right. So I'm thinking, like, when I think of bacteria, I think of strep throat. And like, so is strep throat a bacterial infection?
Yes, I think that's caused by some strain of like Streptococcus. And so, interestingly, there are a lot of different kinds of Streptococcus, and there are some that are native to the mouth, so they're part of like the human mouth microbiome.
Okay,
and they're there, they're okay, they don't cause disease. But if you get a strain that's problematic, or maybe one of the good strains is localized to a spot that it's not supposed to be, that's when you can get like illnesses.
Okay. And then I know that there's good bacteria and bad bacteria. And is good bacteria what goes in yogurt I don't know. Tell me about the good and the bad of the bacteria.
The
families.
Good, the bad, and ugly. Actually, I do some work with E. coli, but a lot of what I do is focusing on the good bacteria that live in the human gut.
Okay.
We call this like the human gut microbiome, and it's like a ton of different species that live together in your gut, and they don't cause disease. They like do a lot of important functions and kind of help you metabolize certain foods that you can't otherwise get nutrients from. So they're generally considered good guys.
Okay.
Now, when we think about yogurt, this gets a little complicated because a lot of times they think probiotics are pitched as like good bacteria that you eat and then they get added to your microbiome and then they help do good things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually not entirely clear if when you eat them, they're actually able to settle in to your microbiome.
Oh, okay.
A lot of times we've done some experiments in the lab actually where we tried to like isolate bacteria from yogurt and honey and some other foods that are known to have a lot of like probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
I think some kombucha too. And then we introduced it with a lot of other gut strains that grow together and kind of mimic what happens in our intestines.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor probiotics just got like kicked out entirely.
Oh, okay. So it sounds like what you're saying is advertisings are misleading.
I might be hinting at that.
Oh, okay.
So I think we don't know enough to be really certain, but we can say that like eating those is not harmful to you.
Okay.
So that's good. And there is some evidence that suggests that not necessarily the bacteria in these like fermented foods like yogurt and kombucha, those might not be super helpful for you.
Uh-huh.
But some of the byproducts in those foods do seem to be good.
What do you mean by the byproducts?
So like if you have kimchi or something where there's like a lot of microbes that go in and ferment the cabbage, they sort of change the composition of the cabbage.
Yeah.
And they take some different like kinds of molecules and change them into ones that are a little bit more beneficial for you.
Okay.
Is the idea.
So do you, like when people find out you know about gut bacteria, do they pepper you with questions at parties because it seems like because everyone's on a diet, so everybody wants to, and you know, or everyone's into like health, so is this something you get?
I do get a lot of questions, yeah, and I feel like I always have to give the disclaimer that like I care and study mostly the aspects of these bacteria that have nothing to do with like human health.
Okay. So then let's talk about the research that you do. So explain it to someone who's dumb. That's me.
Okay. Stop me if I say anything that's confusing.
Oh, don't worry.
Okay. So what I study is how, in general, these complex groups of bacteria that live in the human gut, and also I'm hoping to do a little work with communities that live in soil, how they kind of arrange themselves spatially to work together really well.
So, because that was a question I was going to ask you. You have all of these bacteria in the gut. Are they working in concert? Are some of them warring with one another? How do they coexist?
Yeah. So that is an excellent question. And I think there are like hundreds, if not thousands, of people working right now to try to answer that.
Wow. Okay.
And so there's some interesting research that a few of my lab mates have done that has shown where if you kind of study what exact like foods these microbes eat and then what they secrete as waste products, it looks like they're competing with each other a lot.
Okay.
But there are some other communities. So I have a lab mate that studies not the human microbiome, but actually the fly microbiome.
Okay.
And so interestingly, in their gut, it looks like there are two main species that share a lot of resources. So one will take some like product and then convert it into a byproduct that's useful for the other.
Oh.
So they're just like helping each other out.
Oh, okay. So it's like, so a fly eats poop, it goes into their system, it poops out something that another can eat. And then that it's like they're just keep pooping until it's all used up?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Wow. Okay. The humans hopefully don't eat poop.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the things in your gut being in competition with one another, how does that play out? Let's say if you're eating something that goes in, mm-hmm. like what would trigger that competition?
Yeah. So this is a really exciting field because I think, first off, there's sort of competition in who gets exposed to the nutrients first.
Okay.
So if you think about the organization of the human intestine system,
okay.
stuff goes through the small intestine first, mm-hmm. and then it'll enter the large intestine.
Okay.
And now most of the bacteria actually live in the large intestine. But there are some that live in the small intestine. The issue is the small intestine is really acidic. It has a low pH. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of movement in those muscle tissues. So mm-hmm. it's just it's a really rough environment to live in okay. if you're a bacterium.
Okay.
And then the large intestine is slower moving, kind of more neutral area. It's safer to be in.
Okay.
So one strategy to get more of the nutrients is to figure out how to survive in the small intestine.
Okay.
And then there's tons of food in there. You get to just as long as you can survive, mm-hmm. you can kind of thrive with all that nutrients. But then if you're in the large intestine, there are a ton of bacteria, so there's a lot of competition.
Okay.
And then by the time food makes it from the small intestine to the large intestine, it's not the most exciting food anymore for bacteria.
Okay.
It's kind of harder to break down and get nutrients out of, so that's a harsher environment.
Okay.
So one strategy is to just get where the most food is. Another technique, and this is something that we've not necessarily observed directly in the human gut, mm-hmm. But we know some of the strains that live there are capable of doing this, is to literally just kill the other species.
Mm.
So there's this really cool strategy. It's called type 6 secretion systems,
okay.
Or type 6 killing. That's the kind of jargon for it. But basically, it's these bacteria can get a needle
uh-huh.
and stick it into a neighbor and inject a poison
wow.
and kill the neighbor.
Wow. It's like a period drama where
yeah.
they're poisoning one another. I love that. So what happens mm-hmm. when they're dead? Do they just get excreted out or do they devour them?
Also a really, really good question. So we also don't have a great answer to that quite yet.
Oh, okay.
But there's some evidence that so if you think about this dead cell, it's got all the stuff that a living cell needs,
uh-huh.
But it's just no longer living.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were able to kind of, break that up and share the wealth with other cells, then there should be a lot of useful things in there.
Okay.
So it is very likely that these cells are able to be incorporated into other cells once they die.
Okay.
But of course, a lot of biomass of all these cells gets moved out of the digestive system every day when we poop.
Okay.
So either way.
Okay. So are there foods that help populate? I guess I'm trying to figure out how the bacteria get to where they get to live in your gut as mm-hmm. opposed to just, coming through and being pulverized or eaten or just used.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's
how do you get to join the team?
Right. I wish I knew more details on this, but I can explain what I do know.
Okay.
So from infancy, uh-huh. You already, after being born, already have a little bit of a microbiome.
Okay.
And so this is kind of established, from the mother. A lot mm-hmm. of bacteria pass from mother to child. And then through the course of breastfeeding, you also kind of pass some different strains and then interestingly, nourish specific strains. So
okay.
there's some molecules that are in breast milk
uh-huh.
that are really good for this one member of the gut community called Bifidobacterium.
Okay. Bif for sure.
Bif, yeah.
Okay.
And so you can kind of selectively increase the presence of those strains by having breast milk versus something else that doesn't have those same sugar
okay.
molecules.
Okay.
And then just through kind of day-to-day life when we encounter things.
Or kids eating dirt.
Kids eating dirt, yes. things will make it through the digestive tract and get incorporated in.
And that's very rare that it happens because it has to be, your body has to be on alert for all the other bacteria?
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to get through because the immune system, of course, is trying to make sure you don't get a lot of living things in there. And then Of course, like, the first thing, if you make it through the stomach and get into the small intestine, then you have this big task of having to, like, outcompete all the strains that are already there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really hard barrier to cross.
So you talked about the bacteria sort of organizing itself.
Yes.
So you have this lucky bacteria that makes it to the arena. They're hired.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the organization, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've talked about kind of the like small intestine versus large intestine,
mm-hmm.
but now if you focus on the large intestine, instead of thinking about length, think about like kind of relative to the center of the tube where we are.
Yeah. So it's like bleachers and they're organizing themselves in there.
Yeah, yeah. So at the sort of the like outside of the intestine, mm-hmm. closest to the skin, it's like a wall of cells that are like human flesh,
okay.
called the epithelia.
Okay.
There's this little substance that sort of coats it called mucus. And it's similar to like, you know, the mucus you get in your mouth when you have a cold or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a kind of thick and it coats those cells and tries to keep the bacteria out.
Okay.
Because you don't want, there's some bacteria in there that you don't want in contact with the human cells because the immune system will like figure out they're there and kind of freak out.
Mm.
So that it has this nice little buffer of mucus.
Okay.
And so some strains are really good at like surviving in the outer layers of mucus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one kind of little location that some strains prefer. And then there are other strains that don't like mucus at all, and they'll be in the like the very center of the intestine,
okay.
where there's like food particles and stuff, but not mucus.
Okay.
And then in the large intestine, there are these like little structures called microvilli, which are basically like little. They look like little fingers that kind of are human flesh that mm-hmm. stick out into the intestine,
mm-hmm. like anemones.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what it looks like.
Uh-huh.
And they just help your body absorb a lot of stuff. They like increase the surface area of your intestine so you can absorb as many nutrients and like water as you can.
Okay.
So this makes some cool little like tucked away hidden areas that some mm-hmm. other bacteria are really good at colonizing
okay.
that we call crypts.
Okay. So the bacteria, different bacteria figure out ways, like they find their place in the structure,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of move in, set up shop. Then are they replicating themselves? Okay. And
yes.
how do they replicate? Do they divide or?
Yeah. Yeah. So they undergo this asexual reproduction where they don't have to find another bacteria. All they do is eat a bunch of nutrients that are in the area,
mm-hmm.
grow pretty big, replicate their DNA, so a brief time they will have two copies,
mm-hmm.
And then the cell just splits in half, and you have two cells.
Oh, okay, okay. Now, what happens, like, I know that when you take antibiotics, it will kind of decimate all of the bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So then how long does it take for the human gut to sort of reestablish its equilibrium?
Mm-hmm. I think that varies a lot from person to person. But something we found is that it does take kind of a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they think in terms of like not days, but even months to sort of re-equilibrate. And
uh-huh.
you might not necessarily even make it back to like the same microbiome that was normal beforehand.
Why not?
So sometimes if you've completely eliminated a certain species,
mm-hmm.
Like it was just obliterated by these antibiotics, you just won't come across it again or it won't make it into your body again. And so then, you know, you might have different members that can kind of do the same function as that species you lost. But what you had before and after can be really, really different.
So does that mean that there are bacteria that won't come back because maybe they were the ones that existed when you were a baby and now they're all gone? Or like why is it that some of them you won't run across again?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Definitely, like you mentioned, there are strains that are more enriched when you're a baby. And then mm-hmm. as you're an adult, you have very low levels. And so then if you're just not getting exposure to them again, because as an adult, you're probably not like breastfeeding, for example, then you could definitely miss out on regaining those strains. And then sometimes it's just kind of a random process of like what strains you happen to ingest and happen to make it into your gut system.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'll just get some random other strain that performs really, really well. And then if you get the strain you had before, it won't be able to outcompete that new one.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco, who's touching your mind right now. Rachel Porter, who is talking about bacteria. Now, you're studying bacteria in the human gut, but how do you study it? Are you studying it outside of a human gut, or do you have, like, just some random human gut lying around, or do you take samples from a person? How does it, what's your petri dish?
Yeah, so I get to actually use petri dishes. I'm very lucky in this.
Okay.
Because I really didn't want to work with mice, and I didn't want to work with people because I think it's hard. There are a lot of complications when you're using these systems.
Okay.
So I get to use a petri dish.
All right.
But one thing in order to try to mimic the human gut that we absolutely have to do for these strains is make sure there's not enough, that much oxygen in the environment.
Okay.
So in the human intestines, there's a very low level of oxygen.
Okay.
And so some of the species that live there actually cannot handle being exposed to oxygen.
All right.
If you have them just out in the normal air, they will die. So in order to work with these guys, we have this huge chamber in the lab that's like a big plastic bubble around a lot of equipment.
Okay.
And we have to work in there because there's a really low level of oxygen.
Okay.
In the we call it the koi.
Okay. But how do you also replicate the villi that things go, and the mucus?
Yeah. So again, I'm doing a really simple kind of test.
Okay.
Of the spatial dynamics, so I don't actually replicate those. I mean,
okay.
Ultimately, we would really like to, but we're really just starting off this project. So I'm just using petri dishes, and our idea here is that we think there are kind of two factors to how bacteria organize themselves.
Okay.
And so one of those would be their interactions with the host. So like we talked about, maybe these bacteria like the mucus, or maybe they want to be up against the epithelia or in mm-hmm. those crypts.
Mm-hmm.
So that has to do with the way the bacteria and the host interact.
Okay.
But then the other side, and this is what I'm really focusing on, is how bacteria interact with themselves. And so, for example, if you have two different strains that like to eat the same food, and so mm-hmm. they're always at war with each other,
mm-hmm.
we'd expect they probably aren't thriving in the same environment.
Okay.
They might have, you know, kind of separated mm-hmm. so they each have their own turf.
Okay.
And so this is what I'm primarily investigating. And for that, we don't actually have to use, like, something that looks like the human gut. We can just use a petri dish and see how they kind of fight out for space on that.
Well, then let's say they replicate, and like, are we talking they're replicating millions, thousands? And if so, do they work with each other mm-hmm. or are they suddenly in competition with one another?
So they replicate very, very quickly. For some of these strains, like every 20 to 30 minutes, you can get another copy.
Uh-huh.
And so some, it takes a little longer. You'll have like maybe one division per day. But even that is pretty quick. So yes, we have these guys like all replicating on a plate and kind of growing outwards. And we're not quite sure yet like how that affects their spatial dynamics. So I'm in the process of doing a big experiment to mm-hmm. start kind of seeing how much separation there is between different species.
So then once there is this separation, do they get along with one another, or is it like, okay, we're competing for resources now, it's all out war?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, we don't know. So I think there are a few different kind of possible answers that mm-hmm. we're hoping to differentiate in between.
Mm-hmm.
So one would be that maybe you have, there's like this, I work with a group of 15 strains at one time.
Okay.
And maybe like there are three groups of five
uh-huh.
that like all get along together. But those three groups could be at war with each other.
Mm.
So we could expect that maybe we get these like kind of little clusters of like the three groups where they have their own turf and it's got like a couple strains in each and they live peacefully together, but then at the boundaries are fighting it out.
Okay.
We could also see, though, that maybe all the strains are just mixed together across the whole surface and they're just fighting it out constantly. So.
Got it. So it's almost like a microcosmic version of like ancient China.
Yeah.
You know, it was like they're getting along here, these little tribes, but at the borders, there's constant skirmishes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the like drama of human history happens right. like every day in our petri dishes.
Sometimes I think, oh, what if there's little worlds on a microscopic level that we just aren't aware of? But that's just me.
Yeah.
But so what do you feed the bacteria since they're not in a human gut? How do they get their nutrients?
Yeah, so we use what is basically like Jello for bacteria.
Ooh, I like Jello.
Yeah, not this Jello though. It's super salty.
Oh, okay.
it's the whatever the bacteria prefer, which is in the case for the gut bacteria, we feed them a mixture. It's called BHI,
mm-hmm.
and it has brains and hearts that are left over from like animal slaughter processes.
Oh, okay.
Kind of blended up.
Like a slurry?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so it is kind of gross.
But they like it?
They like it, yeah.
Okay.
I don't love making it. It smells kind of bad, but the bacteria are happy, and that's what matters.
Okay. And so when you feed it to them, do you pour it in and they convert it and you look in the tray a little while mm-hmm. later and it's all gone? Or what does that look like?
So for this, actually, we'll take this kind of mixture of the slurry, which is actually they go ahead and dry it out and powder it.
Okay.
And so we buy it in that form and we'll mix it with water. And then this molecule called agar, it's kind of like gelatin and Jello, where it makes it form that kind of jelly consistency.
Okay.
So we just mix that together and then we'll pour it in little petri dishes.
Uh-huh.
And so then you just have these little like plates of bacteria food. And so you can just put the bacteria on top and they'll grow and spread. And even though, you know, bacteria are so small, you can't see individual ones, they grow and they'll form like millions and millions of cells overnight. And so you can see the big colonies? Yeah, the colonies that they'll form.
Okay. So, and at some point the food just disappears and you got to put more food in? Or?
So they actually, they don't convert. We give them a lot of food.
Oh, okay.
And so the agar will remain. If you let a colony grow like as long as it can and get as many nutrients as it can, it'll probably spread across most of the plate.
Okay.
But the nutrients, the size of like the agar pad that they're growing on will stay about the same.
Okay.
They'll suck the nutrients out, but then like the leftover jelly bit stays.
Do you ever get so much bacteria in a petri dish that you have to now subdivide it and move some to a new dish?
Oh, yeah. So typically we'd like to work with like really freshly grown bacteria.
Okay.
So if I'm doing
ageist.
An experiment, yeah. Well, we want to make sure they're alive.
Okay.
So we'll like on a daily basis or a couple days, just go ahead and like take a few bacteria from one plate and then move them to another to make sure they have all the nutrients and space they need.
Okay. Now let's talk about things that could happen that would damage the bacteria. So are there types of foods or nutrients or things that happen in the intestine besides taking antibiotics that can decimate the gut biome?
Mm-hmm. So off the top of my head, I know that the diet has a really big impact on the microbiome. I think mm-hmm. that's pretty commonly accepted knowledge these days. And so one thing that the microbiome really thrives off of are kind of complex sugar molecules like fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you kind of compare like whole wheats and vegetables and things that do have a lot of sugar, but it's in really complex forms, that's a lot better for the gut microbiome than just like straight table sugar.
Okay.
And so part of that is because you have this big diversity of different molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And so certain members will be of the microbiome will be able to eat some of those, but not others. And so then instead of like all competing for one really simple resource, you have kind of a diverse buffet that different strains can eat at, and then that maintains more different kinds of strains. So having diverse food intake and high fiber is really good for the maintaining a diverse microbiome. And then interestingly, there's one study I can think of that has shown that if you have these, you know, kind of fiber-rich diets that have a lot of things that mm-hmm. The microbiome likes, that can kind of help protect your mucus layer, actually.
Mm.
So we mentioned before, at the edge of the intestine, there's this sort of thick mucus layer that kind of protects the skin cells.
Mm-hmm.
If that gets too thin, then some of the bacteria can get too close to the epithelia.
Oh.
And then your immune system freaks out. And this is, we're not sure if it causes or is just kind of a side effect of diseases like IBD and Crohn's.
Oh, okay.
But it's definitely associated with that. So it's really important to have this thick mucus layer. And if you don't have a lot of food that your microbiome likes to eat,
mm-hmm.
it can start eating that mucus and cause it to be thinner.
Okay. And then how does that, like as a person, how would mm-hmm. you know that that's going on?
I think unless it's in a pretty severe case, you don't.
Okay.
But of course, if you have symptoms of IBD, with irritable bowel disease,
mm-hmm.
Then maybe that's something you would like see a doctor for and they'd bring it up as a possibility.
Okay. Well, we're almost out of time, which is unfortunate because I find this fascinating. So for our listening audience, what would you recommend if for someone who finds bacteria interesting now that they've heard it? What reading or website would you recommend for them to get kind of a good grasp?
Mm-hmm. I am kind of blanking on its title right now, but there's a good book called, I think, The Multitudes Inside Us.
Oh, okay.
That discusses the human or the microbiome. And I think in general, there's also another book whose titles I'm forgetting by Justin Sonnenberg, he's a professor at Stanford that our lab does some work with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written a good book that kind of specifically focuses on like the human side and like what to eat.
Okay.
But in general, I think there's a lot of kind of popular science news articles out there right now about the microbiome.
And if people want to find out more about the research that you guys are doing, how would they go about doing that?
Mm-hmm. So our lab has a website that's called whatislife.stanford.edu.
Ooh,
and so that has references to some of the current work we're doing, and it also has a list of publications for all the recent stuff we found out. And so that's one way to connect with our work.
Excellent. Well, Rachel Porter, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to rant about bacteria to you.
Yeah. Okay, people of Earth, bacteria. I know. I like weird stuff. And it's great that there are other people who like that kind of stuff and want to study it and understand it and make it understandable, because I found everything you said actually very accessible and understandable, and that made me super
Yay.
Happy. So if you don't have the benefit of having excellent science teachers, at least you have the benefit of having people from Wonderfest who make it their point to make it understandable to you. Coming up for you, I've got Alvin Orloff, who's written yet another fabulous book, so do stay tuned.
I think we should take a little look through time. We'll see what we can find. Gonna blow your mind. In 1543, Nicholas Copernicus said this while he laid on his deathbed. He said the planets revolve around the sun. He left the Copernican system. Isaac Newton in 1664 discovered gravitational law. Gravity in all its splendor is the force that draws objects toward each other. Somebody with an electric personality is Michael Faraday, Mr. Electricity. His experiments in 1821 led to the first generator. I think we should take a little look through time. We'll see what we can find. I bet it's gonna blow your mind. How about we take a little look through time? See what we can find. Gonna blow your mind. Charles Darwin in 1859 said organisms evolve slowly over time, and all of these changes allow them to survive. Louis Pasteur in the 1860s discovered microorganisms bring diseases. He realized bacteria can be killed with heat and disinfectants, so wash your hands. Albert Einstein's theory of relativity has nothing to do with your family tree. Nope. It explains relationships between distance, speed, and time. That was in 1905. I think we should take a little look through time. We'll see what we can find. I bet it's gonna blow your mind. How about we take a little look through time? See what we can find. Gonna blow your mind. In 1928, Alexander Fleming discovered the first antibiotic penicillin. He grew it in his lab using mold and fungi, which made germs pack up and say bye-bye. DNA makes up our genes. Blue denim is not what I mean. James Watson and Francis Crick found the double helix structure in 1953. La da 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 da. La la. Should take a little look through time. We'll see what we can find. I bet it's gonna blow your mind. How about we take a little look through time? See what we can find. Gonna blow your mind. Gonna blow your mind. I think we should take a little look through time. We'll see what we can find. I bet it's gonna blow your mind. How about we take a little look through time? See what we can find. Gonna blow your mind.
That's Renaud Foncoeur and the evolution of science from Brain Beats, because it's got all kinds of fun stuff. Speaking of fun stuff, I've got some fun stuff right here. I'd like to welcome the author du jour, fabulous Alvin Orloff. Hello.
Hi, Marilyn.
How's it been going?
Everything's super.
Yay. Now, you've written like a million books, and you've written a million, and this is 1 million and one.
Sort of, yeah, five. I think five and, you know.
Well, for me, yes. Like you're a prolific author in my yes. eyes. So talk about what's the new book?
The new book is called Vulgarian Rhapsody, mm-hmm. and it is a wicked social satire set in the fateful year of 1999 when San Francisco was going through the very first wave of the dot-com boom, which some of you may remember was the first tech wave to hit the city.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the city was awash with young people with lots and lots of money. And it was very disconcerting to people who were old and kind of had moved to San Francisco to be bohemians, mm-hmm. Because they didn't have any money and then they weren't the new thing anymore. And so they felt sort of displaced and sad. The Vulgarian Rhapsody follows a few people. There's the narrator, who is an extremely judgmental unnamed character. Mm-hmm. There is Harris, who's the chief character, who is a shiftless, good-for-nothing barfly. And of course, you know, shiftless, good-for-nothing barflies are kind of the canary in the coal mine when it comes to, you know, economic downturns. He works as a part-time telemarketer and just doesn't have any money. And the other character is Maxine, who is a frighteningly ambitious transsexual cabaret singer. Mm-hmm. And so the plot basically revolves around Harris, the barfly, being so annoying that he gets Maxine to throw him out of his house, or out of their apartment, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then he has to go around to his various dysfunctional friends and try to convince them to let him move in, because the rents are now suddenly so high right. that there's nowhere for him to live.
Well, for our listening audience who may be young-ish, I remember those days, because I remember no matter where you went, everyone, you would always overhear on the Muni or just walking down mm-hmm. the street, people talking about housing in a way that you never heard before. It was like you at least 3 times a day you'd hear
yeah.
a conversation, because yeah. everyone was worried about not being able to afford their rent. And it was like really kind of the last time that you, as a person who made a normal salary, mm-hmm. could move from place to place.
Yeah.
Nowadays,
exactly.
you if you lose your place, you're done, because mm-hmm. you can't afford it.
And when I was just leaving high school and, you know, learning about the ways of the world, this would be like in the 1980s, mm-hmm. you know, it was normal to consider that, you know, you'd pay about a quarter of your monthly salary in rent. That was mm-hmm. considered normal. Now it's considered normal to pay a third, but everyone's paying half.
Yeah.
And so there's it's just been this huge, huge change. But at any rate, my book isn't really about an economic survey of what happened to people when that – it's really more of a comedy of manners that mm-hmm. just happens to take place during a period when people were being dislocated by this new tech wave.
So did you base your characters on people that you knew loosely?
I'm going to say what every writer in the whole world says, and okay. that is that all the characters are me in some sense, and I also have magpie picked a few little characteristics from people around me, of course.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely I see myself in the three main characters. Maybe more, maybe not as much as not all of them to the same degree, but yeah.
So you so the book right before this was Disasterama.
Right.
And so what was then the inspiration after Disasterama to write this book?
Believe it or not, I wrote this book in 2001.
Oh.
It was kind of fresh on the heels of the whole transformation in San Francisco Bohemia happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all my friends had moved to the city to either be drag queens or hippies or punks or, you know, what have you, theater people. And we were all like, you know, incessantly talking about, you know, oh my God, what are we going to do? And literally, I'd say 2/3 of my friends left town mm-hmm. over a period of, you know, from 1995 to 2000, 2/3 of my friends left town. And, you know, I'm a longtime San Franciscan. For me, leaving San Francisco just sounds like the worst thing ever.
Because, yeah, me too.
Yeah. I mean,
born here.
Yeah,
so.
there's weather out there, and people think wrong thoughts, and you know, yeah, it's scary out there outside of San Francisco. So so I managed to stay, but I sort of channeled my anxiety into writing this book about people who were, you know, facing what we were all facing at that point, which was trying to. To keep our places.
Then why did you not publish it then? Why now?
Well, it I did try to publish it then.
Oh, okay.
I was unable to. So I let it sit for 20 years. And then I had my 60th birthday and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so old. I'd better publish it now because I'll be pushing up the daisies before long. I want to get it out there. So then I rewrote it and my publisher Three Rooms Press from New York, a fabulous, wonderful publisher. They liked it. So here it is.
So you're saying you rewrote it. So what was it like to revisit this work that you did 20 years ago?
Well, I think that my writing style is – my mood was the same, but my writing style has evolved somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
I learned to write by doing open mics. And when you go to open mics and read your stuff in front of other people, it's a very different sort of writing that comes out than if you're writing on the page. You learn not to go on, like your sentences got to be shorter.
Mm.
You've got to be a little bit more punchier with, you know, getting to the point. I consider it a great teaching tool to go to if you want to become a writer, go to open mics and read in front of other people.
Now, when I think of open mic, I think of comedy things, but you're reading like there's writers
open mics? There used to
be
a lot of writing open mics. Open mics for it was usually for poetry and spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
Spoken word was what everybody was calling it.
Okay.
And you know, there had been open mics for a long time for comedy. And then in the 90s, very start of the 90s, there was a vogue for spoken word open mics.
Interesting.
And,
I don't think I'd ever heard of that.
Yeah. And it got very popular with Los Angelino celebrity types. Like, you know, Brat Pack people would show up at the open mics to do spoken word. And spoken word people went on the Lollapalooza tours.
Okay.
And, you know, I didn't do any of that. But I went to the open mics. There was one called Kvetch run by, I guess, Sadie. Oh, gosh, I've forgotten her last name. And my friend Tara.
Uh-huh.
And, there was one at Clubstitute. There were a lot of them. And, you know, sometimes there would be comedians there or musicians. But primarily, they were people writing little, like, personal essays or diatribes or, you know, prose poems.
So do those still exist, or are they a relic of the past?
They're mostly a relic of the past, but you can still find them.
Okay. Do you ever do them at your bookstore, Fabulosa?
You know, we were doing one for a while, and then it stopped because...
Pandemic?
It was actually a little before the pandemic. I think the energy on them and any individual thing like that can run out.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you talk about... was it called Bulgarian Rhapsody even then?
No, no. Actually, I am totally indebted to my publisher for coming up with the name Bulgarian Rhapsody. I didn't know what to call it.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah.
What was your working title before they came up with this?
Frenemy.
Oh, okay.
Because Harris, the protagonist, is everybody's best frenemy. He's like always got a little like passive-aggressive dig he can sort of get into. He's always trying to undermine the people around him with little sharp quips and bitchiness of things like that. And so, yeah, he was the source of the title Frenemy.
Okay. So was he loosely modeled on?
Nope. he was a Frankenstein assemblage of characteristics from people, you know, around me, and of course myself.
Okay. So in Bulgarian Rhapsody, you talk about all of the people who feel like they're no longer the hottest thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit more about that that sort of mindset where suddenly you go from being everybody's sweetheart and sought after mm-hmm. to yesterday's flavor.
Oh gosh, it's hard. I think for a lot of people, San Francisco was like an anti-finishing school. Like they would move here out of college or mm-hmm. even during college, and they would sort of learn to – they would taste what it was like to be a bohemian. They would experiment with like, you know, avant-garde theater or what mm-hmm. have you. And mm-hmm. and then eventually when they realized there was no money in any of this, they would sort of stop doing it or
okay.
move to the suburbs or just get a job that precluded, you uh-huh. know, going out and spending 30 hours a week on –
get their MBA or
something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the horrible, you know, wake up and smell the coffee, get a life type thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, so I think for a lot of people there was a time limit on how much they would devote to, you know, bohemian existence mm-hmm. to begin with. But between the start of the tech wave in 95 and 2000, you know, the amount of time you could afford to do that went from, you know, a few years to zero, unless you had a rent controlled apartment.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, does that? I guess when you're talking – so these are people who are trying on the mantle of bohemia, the mantle
right.
of hippie, or the mantle of punk.
But the people that I'm writing about mostly, like Harris and Maxine, are people who – well, Maxine certainly. She's in her 40s. She's a lifer. Some mm-hmm. people are lifers, and they will never stop no matter what. And
yeah, it wasn't something she just put on. It was
right.
her way of being.
It was her way of being.
And San Francisco
yeah,
was
exactly.
a place to go to be.
Right. And, you know, for a lot of people, like especially if you're trans like she was, there really wasn't an option anywhere outside of San Francisco or maybe downtown Manhattan, you mm-hmm. know, to do that. And so, yeah, she's a lifer. Harris, on the other hand, he's kind of a – I don't know if anybody out there has ever experienced this – the sort of person who's not really quite creative. They just really like to critique other people.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone who stands back and watches other people and figures out what's wrong with them. That's his natural stance
yeah.
in life.
Criticizing instead
he's
of
a,
creating.
He's a critic, right.
Okay.
And criticism can be creative, but – if you want it to be creative, you've got to put a lot of yourself into it. You've got to make yourself a little bit vulnerable, express, you know, opinions that could potentially be, you know, aligned with a political or cultural viewpoint. Harris is less into that and more into like, oh, it's not good enough. He's more of the person who's like, oh, you messed up. Oh, you
uh-huh.
blew it. You blew it. That's
just
his favorite place. Yeah, kind of like that.
Okay. And all of this is a comedy.
Yeah, it's a comedy. Yes, it's a comedy of manners. A So
in writing it, in rewriting mm-hmm. it, was there a passage that you were like, wow, this stands the test of time. This makes me laugh still today.
Yes. Yes, there was. My favorite part is when there's a few chapters where the narrator, who I have mentioned is very judgmental, mm-hmm. just like lets loose on Harris and just like kind of reads him to filth. Yeah. And those are my favorite parts, and I think those stand the test of time.
Okay. And when did the book come out?
On the 17th or 19th of last month.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. So for people who are now intrigued, how would they go about getting a copy of
this
book?
Well, I would suggest the best way is to go to my bookstore's website. Now, of course, you can go to Amazon or what have you, but, you know, you can also go to fabulosabooks.com, which is a bookstore that I just by happenstance am the proprietor of.
Very nice.
Buy it that way.
And where is Fabulosa?
It's on Castro Street, right here in the heart of San Francisco, kind of almost the dead center geographically almost.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like on Castro between 17th and 18th?
Between
18th.
Market. Yeah. Between Market and 18th. Right near Cliff's Variety, a fabulously entertaining store for knickknacks and whatnots. And very near the Castro Theater.
Very good.
The beautiful, beautiful Castro Theater.
Well, Alvin Orloff, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I haven't read this one yet, but I've read all the others, and I just find your books very moving and entertaining in, you know.
You're too kind. You're too kind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, people of Earth, we've had science, and now we've got literature. If you can't find something to enjoy or to intrigue, it's because you're actively working against yourself. Don't do that. Go out and take part in the world. Take part in the science. Take part in the literature. Take part in the art. Just let your mind be touched. I'm going to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring ear hole, but I'm going to leave you with some Red Garland. It's Tweedledee from Anad's Blues. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.